Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. So that was Thailand. It's known as Thai meditation. Hot, hot, and hotter. What was you were trying to create Thailand for us?
I had it low when everybody was complaining. And I turned it up and
Here we go. So we have some folk who are anthropologists. I think the only way you can understand something is by practicing it. So the only way you can understand really of being a potter is by making pots. So the only way you can understand playing hockey, I suppose, is by playing hockey. But I think so Buddhism is a huge topic, and there is so much to it. But certainly, I think you see that meditation is not easy. I don't know, if you've never meditated before and you sit down and you try to calm the mind, you see that the mind can be a pretty recalcitrant space. You try to say, well, you just behave yourself, and it seems to want to do what it wants to do. It reacts, and it has memories, and it goes off into shopping trips, and it plans revolutions, or talks to itself. There are committee meetings up there that go on, and there's a whole range of things that we experience. So to actually train the mind to calmness, you can close that now. To actually train the mind to some sense of stillness is a big task. It's quite difficult. And in the training of the mind, you come up to all kinds of obstacles. So people were sleepy. It's very hot, so I kind of stopped the meditation because too many people were asleep. And you face all kinds of difficulties like that. And like any training, whether it's athletic training or training in craft or any profession, you really have to just do it, don't you? You have to do it and see what the results are in your mind, and keep inquiring, trying different things, seeing what kind of obsessions your mind gets into. So that part of meditation, it also, I think, brings edification to how you normally think, because what your inner world is when you're meditating is also your inner world is when you're not meditating. It's the same stuff, isn't it? It goes on. So you actually learn a lot, and that's not Buddhist. It's human. It's not doctrinal. Fear is not fear, and the understanding of fear is not doctrinal. Annoyance. I was getting annoyed at the heat, and then I got annoyed at this. So watching, this is annoyance. This is annoyance. And annoyance isn't Buddhist, and it's not non-Buddhist. It's human. But the understanding of annoyance, say, and the capacity just to witness it and see it trying to take off, and like the phrase I've been using is that DUI, driving under the influence. See, if I start driving this monastery under the influence of annoyance, we're going to get in trouble, and I'm going to get in trouble. And quite often we are living under the influence of all kinds of unskillful habits and tendencies. And if we're not aware of that, well, then we're victims. We may be politically free to some, politically, economically free, live in a liberal democracy, but if we have not understood our minds, not understood what drives our thoughts, not understood our own strengths and weaknesses, then we're not free. And then our well-being is sort of very much dependent on causes and conditions outside of us. And so Buddhism emphasizes a lot inner responsibility, inner awareness, inner vigilance, understanding yourself, as opposed to inner judgments. There's a difference between, say, feeling annoyance and just being very mindful of annoyance, and then being judgmental about that annoyance. I shouldn't be annoyed, or it's your fault that I'm annoyed. That's not awareness of annoyance. It's, of course, reacting in an annoyed way. And sometimes it goes inwards and sometimes it goes outwards. And so what we try to do, as I was saying, while we're having tea after lunch, is we really try to look at the phenomenon of consciousness before we start to create a whole bunch of stuff around it. So what does, like, annoyance feel like before I create something around that? Or what does heat feel like before I create annoyance around it? And that takes quite a lot of acuity. You have to really be on the game, don't you? You have to really be on the ball. You have to be not only with the outer world, you have to be with your inner world. And so Buddhism emphasizes awareness, presence, knowing what's going on and being responsible for that inwardly. The framework of the Buddhist teaching, you have to, I find it helpful to understand what context the Buddha lived in and what context he taught through. And for me, one of the things I like to, in talking about other religious traditions, I like to just note that, say, the Buddha's own religious milieu, it wasn't theistic per se. It wasn't like the Abrahamic religions where you had a creator God. So if you look at Islam or Judaism or Christianity, you have a creator God. And then there are different definitions of that. So you have a whole range of, from Meister Eckhart to Jerry Falwell, it's a whole kind of range of defining God. So that's a particular model of religious thought. The model that the Buddha used was more a model which talked about rebirth, about the coming and going of things, the arising and ceasing of things, the birth and death of things. And his search for spiritual enlightenment was couched in the way of searching for the deathless. So that's a whole different way of thinking or talking, searching for the deathless. And then his realization was, there is the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the deathless. So I think to understand how the Buddha taught, you have to take that on board. So he has this realization, and it's couched in this particular way. And then what he teaches not to get distracted by things which are not the deathless, which are not the uncreated. So it's different than teaching in a theistic way. Not to argue for or against theism, but it's a kind of different model of talking, right? So in his own enlightenment, then he was, when he decided to teach, he realized that not everyone would be interested in the most refined insights of enlightenment, and he realized that the people had different capacities and different interests. So he tried to teach to the person, right? He tried to see, okay, this person is, this is where they're at right now. What can I offer them? That kind of pragmatic and personal teaching. And so sometimes he would simply teach the need for living a good life, living a good ethical life, not harming beings, being responsible in family life and social life, caring for one's environment. And so our monastic rules have a lot of that, just caring for the place we live, practicing communication which is not harmful or divisive, living a life where we're not harming beings. And so there's a lot of teaching about just a good life, a good life based on the golden rule, based on being a decent person in your family. And that he was that wasn't an end point for this teaching, because the Buddha didn't teach any kind of social utopia. He didn't say that if you get all your ducks lined up, you'll be really happy. He said your ducks are not never and never going to be all lined up, but at least take care of your ducks. Terrible image. But so take care of the social part of your life. Live it well, because that'll be a foundation for your meditation. Because a life which is not lived well, a life which is lived in deceit or abusively or whatever, is a life filled with regret, remorse, and that needs distraction. A person who lives very unskillfully needs distraction, because their minds are too confused to meditate. So the teaching lays out that whole strata of social life. And that's quite a package, just to live the good life. And then it suggests ways of looking at consciousness, which are not just about my storyline, but they're about the way the mind is constructed, and the way the mind works, and the way the emotions work. So you have Buddhist psychology and Buddhist analysis of mind. And all of that, one of the constant themes you get is that the body is a very uncertain place. The emotions are very uncertain. One's thoughts are very uncertain. Relationships are very uncertain. The environment is more and more uncertain. The economy is uncertain. So this idea of uncertainty is a very powerful one in Buddhism. And so he's saying, if you're, and remember now, he's coming from his own insight. It's not just an abstract statement that life is uncertain. He's saying these things are uncertain. Relationships are uncertain. Your emotions are uncertain. Your body's uncertain. These things are uncertain. And why he's saying that is because he's realized certainty in some way. He's enlightened. He's realized the deathlessness, and he wants to share that. And the way he shares that is to say, well, if you're interested in this insight that I'm trying to share with you, that first of all, that means faith. You know, that okay, I think you've got something, and I'd like to have it too, right? And so it would require faith in that sense. So then at least the way I read this teaching is that he keeps pointing to the fact that if you're looking for certainty, how are you going to find it in the uncertain? You know, if you're looking for fulfillment, how can you find it in that which is not really going to fulfill you, really, because it'll always change? So without dismissing beauty and relationships and warmth and comfort and Bernini exhibit at the National Gallery and, you know, these lovely things. Without dismissing those, he's just saying, well, they're limited. The way they can fulfill you, they're very limited by your senses, by your situation, by your economy, by so many things. So if you're really interested in this realization, then you have to start looking somewhere else. If your attention is always on the uncertain, how can you find the unborn, the uncreated, the unoriginated, nirvana? So we have the ideas about letting go. So let's say I'm at work, and a friend of mine just got works for the government, and his department just got a notice that within 12 months half of the people, of 300 people, will be sacked, right? Problem, mortgage, wife, kids, monks to feed. You know, so what arises, of course, is fear. Fear and worry, and it has to, you know, it's natural. And so on one hand, he has to sort out livelihood, but on the other hand, if his mind is continually grasping fear, If his mind is always just caught up by fear, then not only does he suffer, he can never realize the spiritual center of his being. So he suffers doubly. But if he can see, well, this is anxiety and this is fear, and it's uncertain, it's changing, he has a perspective of that which knows the uncertain, that which knows change. Because if, you know, like when we did this meditation, I suggested to what? Feel the heat and then listen. The heat was changing. It was getting hotter or anyway, it was changing. And the sound was changing. And then the object, the sound, and, you know, they were changing, right? So you could listen. You could feel the body. You could listen. You could feel the body. You could feel the breath. But what is it that knows all that? What is that? Well, you can't find that. It's not an object, it's not hot, it's not cold, it's not big, it's small. But it's there, isn't it? I know when I feel annoyed. Right? But I'm not annoyance. Because if I was annoyance, I wouldn't know it. And if I was totally lost in it, of course, I'd probably have to take some kind of drug. So although annoyance comes and goes, it's uncertain. It's not really who I am, is it? It's not, is it? It's just something that arises and ceases of course in times and conditions. Just like a sound. The sound is an object. The heat of the body is an object. The emotion is an object. Although we say, I am feeling annoyed, actually, it's an object just as the heat is an object. Maybe it's more pulling or more whatever. So the Buddha said awareness is the gateway to his realization. That's the entry point. Not an external experience, not something which is uncertain, but the only place you can find certainty is the awareness of change. And then, so the teaching is like, learn to abide with awareness of change. Now that frees you on many levels. First of all, it frees you from following the delusions of annoyance or fear or anger or jealousy or, you know, all that stuff that we can get caught up into human beings. Self-doubt and self-disparagement and so on. But it also makes awareness sort of available to this realization that the Buddha had. And that's the spiritual part. So the psychological part isn't an end in itself either. Buddhism, like the Buddha didn't teach some kind of ultimate psychology. The psychology is a tool. The psychology is a tool for letting go of attachment, for realizing this kind of liberation. So to sort of, I think, to understand where the Buddha is coming from, at least in Theravada Buddhism, for me that's very, very helpful. What's the context? What was his realization? What was his language? And why does he keep pointing to uncertainty? Why does he do that? Not, you know, what... And it's not just simply like the weather is uncertain. It's not that. It's something much more profound. Why does he keep pointing to, like, this is unsatisfactory? He says your emotions are unsatisfactory or that your body's unsatisfactory. Not in any kind of ultimate sense. It's more like where you can really find fulfillment is in something deeper than your body, than your emotions, than your mind, than your thoughts. So don't follow that, don't pursue that. So the path of Buddha's development, but the Buddhism is a kind of path of developing. What you're developing is a way of life and a way of being which brings you more and more to awareness of things as they are, in a very simple way, just as they are. So like the just watching the heat in the room, how I was getting annoyed with the heat, as long as I stayed aware of the heat, the annoyance couldn't move. But as soon as I was unaware of the heat, the annoyance started to take my mind. And as long as I stayed aware of the annoyance, once it had arisen, it couldn't go to complaint. It wanted to go to complaint very badly. You know, well, who am I going to complain to about this? And as long as I stayed aware of the annoyance, it wouldn't go to complaint. And what is complaint? It's sense of self. Like when you have something you don't want, or when you don't have what you want, the mind complains, right? The mind wants something else. It wants comfort, it wants joy, it wants whatever. And so what we usually do is we usually seek some kind of external thing, some kind of experience to alleviate that, some kind of food. I've been talking with friends about food, how people will use food if they feel lonely, or they feel depressed, right? Or they feel down, or you know, they'll munch on things. Now, munching is not illegal in Buddhism. It's okay. It's all right. But if I feel a feeling of loneliness, right? And then I have a friend who even put it on the fridge. It's not in there. It's great. She has on the fridge. It's not in there. So the loneliness arises, okay? And what do? We seek fulfillment in that which is uncertain and changes. So, whoop, I don't know, banana yogurt, right? So banana yogurt offers a kind of modicum of fulfillment for a brief. But then, of course, what happens is the feeling of loneliness comes up again. And then there's the food again. And then there's a loneliness, and there's the food. And the mind gets caught in a cycle which can never, never bring you freedom. Why? Because it's always on an external thing. Whereas awareness of loneliness, the capacity to just stay very aware of loneliness and not let it go to narratives of, oh, I'm terrible, you know, my life is terrible and they don't love me anymore, feeling sorry for myself. Don't allow it to go in there. Just hang in with the feeling of loneliness without adding to it. Then what you do, you begin to abide in the awareness of change. And that's where the liberating quality of consciousness is, the liberating possibility or the liberating doorway is. Now, it's very hard to sit when you feel lonely. It's very hard just to be with it. It's a lot easier to distract it. And distraction's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But a life lived in continual distraction is a life in which loneliness has not been resolved. And unresolved loneliness leads to more loneliness. Or unresolved fear leads to more fear. And unresolved anger leads to more anger. So one of the ways they talk about liberation or enlightenment in China is it's the death of 1,000 stabs. It's like you really feel lonely or whatever, and you want to lash out or blame or whatever, but you take it and you witness to it and you feel that, and your mind begins to see, well, actually, I'm not that. I'm not lonely. Loneliness is an object, but that's not who I am. And you begin to have freedom within the feeling of loneliness. Loneliness has much less power. It no longer has the power to delude you. It's simply a part of being human. So loneliness is okay, because it changes, it arises, because it causes and conditions. And that's a liberation from loneliness, not potato chips. Huh? So as you do that, you start to get this confidence that, no, that's not me. That's not who I am. It's simply a mood that comes through the mind. And so the same with fear and anger. And the more one does that, the more the awareness begins to have this very powerful sense of presence. And you trust in that more and more, rather than trusting in the pull of things, the pull of emotions, the pull of thought, the pull of delusion. So quite often, my experience in Thailand was just being trapped with things, if I'm thinking about loneliness, just being in a very friendly culture, Thai culture, right? But feeling very lonely, very homesick. Oh, just terrible. We're kind of craving for food and craving for music. And great teacher, great people supporting me, but still I felt lonely. So what do I do with that? Well, I could have, you know, okay, I'm going to disrobe and get some banana yogurt and listen to Santana. All right, yeah, you can do that, and that would, you know, that would make you kind of excited for a while, but it would not answer the spiritual quest. Because the spiritual quest in Buddhism is, well, what is it that's not dependent on these things? What is it that's independent of that? What is it that's uncreated, unarranged, and unformed? So then the kind of challenge was like, okay, you feel lonely, but actually you're okay. Everyone's taking good care of you. So why not just meditate with loneliness as the object, rather than the breath, or a mantra or something? Why not just make your object of meditation loneliness? Why not just get to know it? And as soon as you do that, all the thinking begins to slow down, as I'm not feeding it. And then it becomes like, oh yeah, it feels this way. It's a mood, and then the mood shifts and it lifts, but the awareness is still there, and you begin to know the moods of the mind. Because we are mood beings, aren't we? And we have bodies, but we also have emotions and moods, and we're affected like the sunshine, what it does to you. It's wonderful, isn't it? But then, you know, if it rains tomorrow and it's dark and it's heavy, that affects you. How, if a person comes up to you and insults you, something about whatever, right? You feel that. Your teacher says, "Oh, fantastic!" Your teacher says, "Wow, pathetic!" You know, you're really impacted by that. So as beings, and then we have a whole set of memories. The kind of like I got impacted by my grade one teacher who said, you know, you're hopeless, and then I remembered that in grade two, and then I'm 46, and someone says I'm hopeless. So not only is there that mood, there's this explosion of mood, because I've never really addressed it. But if in one point I say, oh, this is what it feels like when someone names me hopeless. Now, on a social level, I can say, no, you can't do that, you can't abuse me, and so on, that's fine. But at the inner level, I can start to say, well, when a person insults me or puts me down, it feels this way. And rather than get caught up in that whole train of thinking and that, I begin to be aware, that's not who I am. I'm not this self-disparaging person. It's just a feeling which brought these thoughts forth. And I begin to have freedom around that. Rather than always be the victim of everyone's praise and blame. Someone praises me, oh, great. Someone blames me, oh. That's not freedom, is it? Huh? And yet, you know, we can get really impacted. So rather than say I should be some equanimous coconut, right, that never that never feels anything, that when I feel something, to really know it, this is a mood of being put down. I can speak strongly, I can say that's all okay, but to really get in touch with the moods of the mind, because it's the moods that creates a sense of self. You know, if you fall in love, your mood is high. And if you fall out of love, you move slow. I mean, we've seen that. We've all been through that rigmarole, right? And it creates a certain sense of self. So if there's good fortune, then, oh, life is wonderful, isn't it great? And then if there's bad fortune, oh, it's the pits. What a culture this is. Ottawa's a bummer. And so it just leaves in the wind. Leaves in the wind. But when we begin to see, well, what are the moods that are conditioning these I thoughts? These self-thoughts. What is the mood? And where is that taking me? And do I want to be reborn into that realm of thought? Do I really want to do? And we start to make really strong choices. So the mind wants to run with self-disparagement, say. You know, like someone says you're hopeless and you believe them. You say, yeah, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless. You see, and I spill the tea, I'm hopeless. That's the hopeless mantra. And at some point you say, no, that's just a feeling, that's just a mood. And you take refuge in awareness. You take and this is the idea that we use in Buddhism. We take refuge in the Buddha, we're not talking about bowing to golden idols or gods in the sky. We're talking about this quality of awake attention, awareness, as refuge in Buddha. Because the word Buddha means awake. And the difference, say, from feeling annoyed and being awake to annoyance is being very careful and not letting it rule me is taking refuge in knowing, in Buddha knowing Dharma, as we say. But not being awake and then reacting through annoyance is delusion. Is delusion, is suffering, is rebirth, and all the rest of it. So we all face huge challenges as human beings, you know, physically, economically, and so on. But I think the challenge of developing an inner life, developing an inner life of inner vigilance and inner attention and inner understanding, makes it all workable. But if you don't have that, then one's very much a victim to the external things. All right, there's some things to ponder and think about. I'll close there.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.